Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/chapters. There you'll find over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. On this episode of Chapters, our guest Erica describes what it was like growing up in a religious family in Arkansas.
I read my Bible 3 times a day. I had a schedule. I would read it in the morning when I woke up. I would read it in the evening after I took my shower, and then I would read it right before I went to sleep.
Later, she tells us how her reading tastes have changed.
But now I'm really disillusioned with literary fiction. I'm like, oh my God, it has so many of its own tropes, and I'm sick of it. I'm done reading about rich white people who have problems.
We'll hear this and much more. Stay tuned. This is Chapters. Welcome to Chapters. This is the podcast where we hear the stories of readers' lives through the books that have meant the most to them. I'm Mary Mahoney, and today my guest is Erica Lehman. Erica is an Arkansas native who moved to Boston to attend library school. She's a publisher by trade and a lifelong reader turned collector who now owns more than 30 copies of the children's classic, The Little Prince. She also describes herself as a former Christian whose earliest memories of books are of Bible stories, and says of herself that she's a woman who knows who she is, but has yet to see herself in the books she reads. This is her story. Erica, my close personal friend, thank you so much for being on Chapters.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I am a fan of the show, actually, so I'm happy to be here.
Wonderful. I've been anxiously awaiting this conversation. I know you've done some preparation, and I just want to dive right into it. So maybe you can tell me your earliest memory of reading and a little bit about where you're from.
Yeah, being a fan of the show, I knew you were going to ask this one, but I still don't have a very good answer anyway. I don't know if I have very many early memories of reading. Like, I don't remember my parents reading to me or anything, although they probably did. But I remember, you know, in like when you're in first or second grade and you have the textbook of reading, like you're not reading books yet, you're reading a textbook. Mm-hmm. So I remember like the giant McGraw-Hill book like in my backpack. I don't remember reading anything from it. I just remember the book. Like it was a really ugly color. I remember that I was told I was a good reader when I was young, like first grade. Probably my earliest that I can actually date would be, I remember third grade, we had a specific reading class, and I hated the teacher, so some of that has stuck with me.
Why'd you hate the teacher?
She was, I don't know, can we curse on this podcast?
Go for it.
She was a bitch, man. She was the first teacher to make me cry.
Oh my God, what happened?
We had read some book or another. I remember the one book I remember actually reading in the class was, I think, Stone Fox or something, but I don't think it was that book. We read something that involved like finding hidden treasure, and she told the class that she would create a treasure hunt for us. We could go on a treasure hunt, like with a treasure map and everything.
Yeah.
And then it never happened. And so I asked her a couple of times if we were still going to do that. And that's when I learned that teachers really don't like you reminding them of things that they aren't doing. So she like yelled at me and I cried.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was rough.
And how did she respond to your tears?
I don't remember.
Because sometimes if you cry in front of, like if you've annoyed someone, but then you start crying, mm-hmm. you change the dynamic.
I don't know. I don't know if she liked kids. I don't know. I'm sure it wasn't related, but I also remember that she gave my entire class detention one time. And detention meant basically staying inside at recess.
What did you all do?
I don't remember. Probably like 2 kids didn't do the reading or something, or maybe we talked too much. I don't know, but we all had detention as a class.
Did you like my
Stone
casual?
Cold bitch, I'm telling you.
Wow. Did you like my casual use of y'all in honor of your Southern heritage?
Yes, I didn't say where I'm from. I'm from Arkansas originally, but like the Northwest part where we wear shoes. I'm just kidding. The whole state wears shoes, you guys. It's fine. We're a real place. But yeah, people are always asking me when they find out that I'm from Arkansas, they say that I don't have an accent. I do use y'all casually. But they say I don't have an accent. And now I live in Boston now, so I just get really mad. And I'm just like, where did you park your car, huh?
Wow. So you're just bullying. You're putting it on them.
I am, yeah. People don't think it through, you know?
Okay, back to you. So you're young, Erica. You're growing up in Arkansas, where you are wearing shoes.
Yes, I had shoes from an early age.
That's comforting. And you're presumably being read to, you're reading books. Mm-hmm. So are you remembering any significant books that are being read to you? Or what's the first significant reading experience you have that you think mm-hmm. this, you look back and say, this made a big impact on me?
Well, I was raised in a very religious family, so I know there was a lot of Bibles around. My dad had these big, he had these big like floor-to-ceiling bookcases. We actually, it was in our new house. We moved when I was about four, and we built our house, so it was pretty much like to our specifications, kind of. So he had these big floor-to-ceiling bookshelves that he built with my grandfather because they also used to be carpenters. And I remember there was like one whole shelf dedicated to Bibles on this bookcase. All these Bibles. So there were like my dad's various study Bibles, and there were me and my sister's various like illustrated Bibles and children's Bibles. I remember I had this great one. It was called the Children's Gold and Honey Bible. And it was just these little like giant font, like half a page Bible stories with these just like beautiful full color illustrations. And I remember a few stories from that, like Zacchaeus, the tax collector that climbs up in the tree to see Jesus as he walks by. Stuff like that, those little Bible stories.
Oh, yeah, I remember that story, too.
Do you?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Oh, my God, so many people don't know that one.
Oh, I know that. I was at church every week. I know about this.
Do you know the song, though?
No.
Oh, my God.
Are you going to sing it?
Zacchaeus was a wee little man. A wee little man was he. He climbed up in the sycamore tree. Good Lord for to see. Or something like that. I don't know about that last line. I think I learned it in Bible school.
Wow.
I was a kid that I went to Bible school every single summer, but not only did I go to Bible school every summer, I went to all the Bible schools. There were several churches in my town, and I just made the rounds going to different Bible schools.
And would you bring a different Bible to each one? Or
No, I didn't. I had one Bible at a time. You know, like you outgrow your kid's Bible, and then you get like the preteen Bible, and you outgrow that, and you get your teen Bible.
How is a teen Bible different than a preteen Bible?
Oh, man, I had this terrible Bible that was for teens one time. I needed a new Bible. I think I asked for it for Christmas one year. And my mom got me this Bible. Like, I think it was pink, and it was aimed at teenage girls. And so, like, every so many pages of the Bible, there were these, like, glossy magazine-type pages that had, like, personality quizzes and stuff. And I just thought that was the worst thing in the world. I was like, how could you do this to a Bible? This is, like, God's word. Why would you do this? So I made her return it, and I went and picked out my own Bible. And I picked out the Everyman's Bible. Pretty much as opposite from teen girl Bible as you can get. But I picked it because it had a lot of footnotes. I was into it.
You wanted to know more information.
Yeah, I was very, it went into like a lot of the history. Like you would be reading about something and then it would talk about like the geopolitical history of the area or something, you know, mm-hmm. or like the geography and like what it actually means when the Bible says something. Because obviously when the Bible was first written, you were expected to just know this stuff.
Right.
But a lot of the context is clearly lost on us.
So when you were growing up, if you think about a shared reading life among your family members, it's your parents and you have a sister, mm-hmm. right?
I do have an older sister, yeah.
You have an older sister and you have a shelf in your house that's just for Bibles. Is mm-hmm. the Bible the main book that you all
now,
are
I would
reading
say
in common?
The Bibles on the bookcase did not exactly circulate. They pretty much stayed on the bookcase.
Okay.
My dad, I mean, like I said, can you really throw away a Bible? I think that's the main issue here. Like, what do you do with your old Bibles?
Yeah.
They just stay on the shelf. So, like, my dad always had his Bible, but his Bible stayed, like, on the side table next to his chair. He put it on the bottom shelf. Because he would sit in his recliner every morning before we ever got up, and that's when he would do his Bible time.
Okay.
So I never actually experienced my parents reading the Bible much, because they did it before we woke up.
But you were yourself doing it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I was very active in Sunday school and church and, you know, memorizing Bible verses and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Was that a way you connected with other kids, a lot of other religious kids?
Yeah, I mean, before you start school, like, where are you making your friends? I didn't really go to daycare and I didn't go to pre-K. So, like, I made friends at church. My childhood best friend was, I made friends with her at church. And it was nice that we had that because she ended up getting held back in, like, first or second grade. So we weren't together in school anymore. And so mm-hmm. we still, like, could hang out at church.
So what other things are kind of, I mean, the Bible can play a big role in your imagination. Mm-hmm. There's so many different stories. There's songs, as you've just shared with us, coming from the stories. But what else is really kind of like starting to expand or shape your personal imagination? What kind of books are playing a role in that?
Well, I remember that the library was a big part of my life early on. I don't really have a timeline for it, but I know, I mean, I spent a lot of time at my grandmother's house when I was a kid, and we lived, the house that we built was actually 3 miles outside of the city limits. So it was a ways out, and the town that I'm talking about also had a population under 3,000 people. So, like, it was not a big town, and then we lived, like, in the country outside of that town. But my grandma lived right in the middle of town, so, like, I could walk to all my vacation Bible schools from her house. But I could also, like, walk through her backyard and then, like, cut up a grassy alley between a neighbor's house and be at the library. And so I spent a lot of time going to the library. I remember the librarians there let me shelve books. As a kid, it was a big deal. I had a job. I was helping. I remember there was a whole shelf, a few shelves devoted to those kids' mysteries like Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't read those books. I read the Bobbsey Twins. Have you heard of the Bobbsey Twins?
I know all about the Bobbsey Twins.
Do you?
Oh, yeah. I read the Bobbsey Twins.
Nice. That was my kids' mystery of choice. I chose it over Nancy Drew or Hardy Boys. I really think it's because I could tell it was older and less popular. I think that I wanted to be a book snob as a child.
You were like a five, like an 8-year-old hipster in Arkansas. Yeah. Like, no, yeah. Like, it's so like obvious to read Nancy Drew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was way too mainstream for me.
So for people who haven't read the Bobbsey Twins, like what's the premise of the Bobbsey Twins?
Oh man, I like barely remember.
It's a sister, right?
I think it was four kids. I think there was two sets of boy-girl twins, maybe.
Okay.
I think that. Because I think there were an older boy and girl and a younger boy and girl, I think.
Yes.
That's sounding right.
I think so.
Yeah. I looked up in advance the publication date, but I didn't, to make sure it was older than Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys. But I didn't actually look up any of the plot.
Fair enough. So really, it wasn't even about the plot that resonated with you. It was just like you wanted to feel like you were doing something exclusive and...
Probably so, yeah. I think I also liked that, I mean, they looked good on a shelf. There was like a path to take there, you know, a sense of progress.
Yeah. So you worked your way through the whole series?
I probably didn't. Like, I probably was reading other stuff at the same time and then now grew it before I finished. I don't know.
Huh.
But I know I read more than one.
But what are the first books that you're picking? So you're reading the Bobbsey Twins, you're picking that for yourself. But the books that you're reading when you're, I guess, elementary school age that are making you feel seen in some way are your kind of books that are resonating with you?
Hmm. At this point, I really started to emulate one particular friend in my reading life. My best friend, her name is Jessica. And I think we knew each other before because there was like 100 people in my class. Everybody knew everybody from K through 12. We started like hanging out in like fourth or fifth grade. And she was a big reader too. A lot of my friends weren't big readers. So she was a big reader and she also read so much more than me. She would read, I don't think she would call herself a fast reader. So I don't know if she's a fast reader and doesn't know it or if she just spent more time on it. But God, she read so much. I like could not keep up, but I tried really hard. So like, for every 3 books that she would read, I would read one of them because I wanted to read the same things that she was reading. So I tried to read what she was reading a lot of the time, which she was into like, I guess it was later that she kind of got into like fantasy stuff. But we were reading a lot of the same stuff. I know we both went through a big Sharon Creech fan phase. I don't know if you're familiar with Sharon Creech's work. She did Walk Two Moons is probably her most famous. I don't think I've ever read that one actually, although Jessica highly recommended it. But I really liked The Wanderer. That was one. I think it was about a ship. It was a really good one. She wrote like Bloomability, Ruby Holler. There were some more, Chasing Redbird. She had quite a few little like young adult books, I guess, like the ones with the big font. But I really liked that. I went through that phase. I also remember around this time is when, I guess because there was like a reading class, things sort of went around. But I remember reading books and thinking, wow, this does not live up to the hype. So Because of Winn-Dixie, do you know that book?
Mm-hmm.
That was a big one that was popular in the class, and I read it, and I was like, eh.
What's that one about again?
It's about this girl that finds a dog. She lives in Florida, I think, or somewhere in the South, and she finds this dog in a grocery store parking lot. The grocery store is a Winn-Dixie, so she names the dog Winn-Dixie because she's so original.
Big imagination.
I know. I don't remember much of the plot. Like, I know the dog, like, changes her life or whatever, or brings her family together or something. I don't know. I do remember there was one part where she's, I think it's at the library, and she's talking to the librarian, and the librarian has these candies that she gives out, and the candies taste like melancholy. And I was like, where kids were learning the word melancholy, you know? So that's where I learned the word melancholy. But that kind of, that imagery always stuck with me, that you had candy that tasted like melancholy.
Have you ever had a piece of candy that tasted like melancholy?
No, I don't think I have. If it tastes that bad, I don't eat it.
That kind of sounds like an author, like an editor said to the author, you need to put in some vocab words. Right.
Man, I'm rereading The Series of Unfortunate Events right now, along with one of my friends, and I forgot how much of a vocabulary lesson those books are.
Really?
Every page, he's like, he'll use a word, and he'll be like, and of course you know that a hurricane is blah, 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 blah. And sometimes he, like, actually defines the word, but other times he's like, in this context, this word means hates the Baudelaire children. So sometimes it's for humor, and sometimes he's, like, explaining words, and then sometimes he'll use these incredibly big words, but I'm like, wow, that, I don't even know what that means now, so I'm glad you explained it.
Do you resent, did you resent that, though, when you were a kid, if you found a book that was too obviously doing that?
I don't remember noticing it the first time I read these as a kid, so I guess not.
I remember when I was in high school, we had a guidance counselor who was trying to pass off on all of her students a novel that was explicitly written to prepare you for the verbal portion of the SAT.
God.
None of us took the bait, but she was like, guys, you know, if you read this book, you'll learn like some just super casual usages of SAT words. So what's happening in like middle school?
That's when I was going pretty hard trying to keep up with Jessica. And I was also starting to sort of emulate Jessica in other parts of my life, which my mom was not so cool with.
Ooh, what was going on?
Well, like I tried to like dress like Jessica. She wore a lot of dark colors and like baggy t-shirts. So that's what I started wearing. I started wearing like oversized men's t-shirts that had like the Reebok logo on them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Just so I could, you know, look like my best friend. And my mom did not like it. It was a deviation from what I had done before, which was like normal girl stuff, I guess. So
did she sit you down and say, I think Jessica's bad news?
I don't remember if she sat me down, but like, I definitely got the vibe. I was like, I know that she didn't. She was fine with Jessica, I think, until I started trying to be more like Jessica.
Whoa.
We also came from very different backgrounds, Jessica and I, and so I think my mom sort of like low-key didn't approve of really any of my friends' families. I had one friend, my friend who was held back, but we were friends from church. Her family lived in a trailer, and that was like, oh my God.
What was the problem with that?
I don't know. Like, I couldn't tell you. I think my mom just felt like these people had troubled homes or something. I don't know.
Kind of like from that, like, yeah. Sort of.
And Jessica's parents were divorced, so whoa, you know.
Nope. Mm-hmm. If you come from a religious household.
But, I mean, I loved Jessica's mom. I called her my mom, and she, like, gave me a nickname and everything, and it was rad. She was my other mom. I liked going to her house, and I think a lot of the books that Jessica got were actually, like, not from school. They're from her mom's library. Her mom had books. So in middle schools, when Jessica got really into reading these fantasy novels, so she would read about like dragons and wyverns or whatever. Is it wyverns or wyverns? I have no
idea. You're asking the wrong
person. It's
got
a Y in it. But she would read these books. It's a famous author. I can't think of her name right now, who wrote all this stuff. And Jessica went through a bunch of those series. Oh, we both got deep into Tamara Pierce in middle school. Do you know any of her books?
I don't.
She did like young adult fantasy novels and like she was big on quartets. She did a lot of quartets. So there was one about like a woman who wanted to be a knight, and so she like pretended to be a boy and became a knight. And then when she was a knight, she was like, haha, bitches, and she was a lady knight. And that was rad. There was one about a woman who had this power to like talk to animals, and she was big on horses. So that one, I actively tried to get some of my friends who weren't into reading to get into reading. I had a friend who really liked horses, and so I made her read these books where this woman talked to horses.
How'd that go?
She liked it. She actually reached out to me on Facebook years and years later when we were in college, or even after college, I think. She reached out and she was like, what was that book that you had me read? And there was like the horses that she talked to. So it made an impression.
Whoa.
Yeah.
You made an impact.
You did.
But does your mom at this point, when you're friends with your best friend and you're starting to dress like her and you're reading books that are important to her that become important to you, she seems to be picking up on like you sort of fashioning yourself differently than your family. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you're becoming aware that you're doing, or you're just sort of experimenting, trying on different selves?
I don't know. Like, I don't think Well, fashion-wise, I definitely went through a lot of distinct phases from this point on. Though after I finished dressing like Jessica, I went through a year where basically everything I wore was from Eddie Bauer, like the outlet store. So I looked kind of like I should have been 65 years old. I was wearing like a lot of matching sets where there's like a t-shirt and like a button-down shirt that like came as a set.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff. And then after that, the next year, I wore pretty much exclusively t-shirts that said Old Navy on them.
Wow.
Yeah. I got a little more mellow after that, and then I started dressing in like a little bit of everything, but I had some distinct phases. But I don't know if that was full-on identities I was trying out. Like, I was definitely trying to get somewhere with clothes, but I don't know where I was trying to go.
You're trying to be a brand ambassador, it sounds like.
I guess so, yeah. I guess I've always kind of been that way. Like, I find something that works, and then I just keep doing that thing. Mm-hmm. There was a long time when the only place that I could get jeans was at the Gap Outlet Store in Branson, Missouri, which was 2 hours away. So every summer, we would have to drive to Branson to go to the outlet mall, and I would get new jeans. Jeans from nowhere else would work.
That's very specific. Mm-hmm.
There was a time when I only wore Reebok sneakers. Like, nothing else would work.
Wow.
Yeah.
You had, like, kind of a Howard Hughes type teenage.
Yeah, but it kind of, like, changed. Aesthetic. Like, it didn't always stick around. It became something else later. Eventually, Gap jeans quit working for me.
Interesting.
Yeah, Gap outlet jeans. But, yeah, I felt like I had an older sister, you know? And mm-hmm. So when you have an older sibling, especially, you're always kind of trying comparing yourself to them. So I definitely felt like I was missing a connection with my sister. I felt like we were very different people. Hmm. My sister was very much like, she was interested in boys and she wore makeup and she painted her room bright red. I don't know what that
That's
was about.
A choice. Oh my gosh.
All four walls. She took down the Beauty and the Beast wallpaper and painted all four walls bright red. She redecorated her room a few times, so she might have been having more identity crises than I was. I painted my room exactly once. I took out the balloons and confetti themed wallpaper that I had, and I did like a celestial theme. Like, the bottom half of the walls was navy blue, and then there was like the sun and moon celestial theme on like a wallpaper runner, you know, like around sure. the middle, like chair rail height. And then I had a matching bedspread and throw pillows.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It was cohesive.
That's a look.
Yeah. But it was around this same time that I had one of my two major religious crises, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what happened?
I just, when you grow up in the church, you see everyone around you who, I don't know if they're going through the motions, but like, it kind of feels like you're going through the motions maybe. And it's there, they have the real thing and you don't have the real thing. Because you can't ever see what anybody else's struggle is. It's hard to see what someone else's relationship to God is. But, like, I had a great idea of what it was supposed to be, the ideal, and I knew that I didn't have that. Mm. And so I started to get really worried about it and about, like, I don't know, my soul or whatever. So what happened was my dad, I talked to my dad about it because my dad was, like, the most spiritual person in my life. And we sort of started doing this, like, one-on-one Bible study. And my dad and I would sit down and we would, I don't know if we had a booklet or not, or if we were just going through the Bible from something that he had done before. I don't know. But I know I took notes. I took notes and we prayed a lot. And then partway through that, I decided that the resolution was that I was not actually a Christian, that I had been quote unquote saved and baptized. I had like come to Jesus when I was like 7 or 8 and been baptized at that point. But at this point, when I was in 7th grade, I think I decided, I was like, oh, I was too young, I think. I don't know, I didn't do it right or something, or like it didn't take, I don't know. Mm. But I decided that that hadn't been real and that I needed to do it again. So I went through the whole process again, and I, like, my dad prayed with me and he led me through like the standard Baptist prayer that you do whenever someone is like coming to the Lord to be saved. Mm. So I did that again and then like talked to the preacher again. At this point we had a different pastor, they had changed. So I talked to him and then I was baptized again. And I remember this didn't seem weird to anybody. Everybody in my family and at my church and my friends who were religious from different churches and all, they were all very supportive. They were just like happy for me, you know, because it was like, oh, now I was a Christian kind of thing. So that was kind of weird.
Well, had they shared with you that they themselves had been through a crisis of faith or?
No, I don't remember anybody talking about things like that.
And when you were praying with your dad, what were you praying for? Were you praying that you would feel what you thought you were supposed to feel?
I was mostly my dad praying and holding hands with me. And my dad would pray for things like, for like God to reveal what was holding me back and things like that.
Hmm. So you get baptized again.
Mm-hmm.
And did that help or?
Yeah, it felt great. You know, you have that external validation and everyone's happy for you. And then everything, it feels like you've really turned a corner, you know, and it feels like a real landmark and a milestone. So you have this sort of like, it's all built up around it. So for a while, it just everything felt great after that. I was like, oh yeah, that was it. I'm good now.
Hmm.
I ended up not being the case. I had another religious crisis later, which we can talk about in another few years.
Okay.
From now. Around the same time too, I was trying, Jessica was not religious. She had sort of gone to church when she was a kid, but she lost her faith when her parents got divorced. Kind of that traditional, why would God let this happen to me kind of thing. So I was very much like always praying for her, and I like gave her a Bible, which looking back, like, why were you friends with me? I would try to invite her to church and I'd give her a Bible and stuff like that. Like,
and how does that, how was that received when you hand her the Bible?
She was very, she was always very gracious, and she's a much better person than me. So she would just be like, okay, thank you, I appreciate this, I'll keep it in mind, and then like ignore it. And we went back to being normal kid friends, you know?
Hmm.
Like, we didn't really talk about it, but just, like, she knew that I thought about it and I was like worried about her soul or whatever.
And were you saying that to her? Like, I'm worried about your soul.
I don't know if I ever said the words or not. I'm sure I said that, like, I wanted her to be saved and be a Christian.
Oh, boy. I mean, it came from a very sincere
place. I roped my Christian friends into this, too. Like, it was more than just me.
What were you doing?
Just, like, I don't know. I guess trying to get more than one person to be like, this is the right thing for you. You know? Your basic religious peer pressure, I guess.
Which didn't actually work.
I'm not proud of it, Mary.
Look, you know, it is what it is, and it happened.
I feel so grateful that she stayed friends with me. We're friends to this day, and like, I don't know how we made it through.
No, but I think that's such a beautiful story about friendship, because isn't being friends with someone being giving, you're showing yourself as you are with no veneers, this is authentically like who I am right now in this moment. So if you actually hadn't shown her your religious side or your crisis of faith or your very vulnerable desire that here your best friend isn't going to share with you in this spiritual experience, or maybe her soul won't be saved. Like, that's sincerely how you felt at that time. Mm-hmm. And so she got to see who you were and then see who you became. And that feels honest in a way.
Yeah. We had a lot more pit stops on that journey. After my second religious crisis at the end of high school, I was not religious in college. And at that point, like the end of high school and the beginning of college, Jessica was going to church. And Jessica was a Christian at that point. And so that was kind of like a role reversal there.
What?
Yeah.
So wait a second. What happened?
I want to say she did not go to my church. Another friend got her to go to their church.
So really, this is about you.
I think the other church was worse than mine.
Whoa. So what happened at the end of high school? Like, we might as well just like talk about it.
At the end of high school, it was a different kind of religious crisis in that case, because at that point, I was having a lot of the same feelings that like, oh, it wasn't really there for me. I wasn't feeling the way that I was supposed to feel. And so I thought long and hard about it, and I was in youth group at this point, and I had a really like hands-on youth leader and a bunch of peers, you know, and we like talked about stuff, and he was a cool youth leader, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a widespread crisis in my youth group. It was sort of a domino effect. It started with one guy, and then it was me, and then it was somebody else, maybe one other person. We all one by one sort of came to the conclusion that we weren't actually saved again. And at this point, though, what our youth leader was teaching us was that you can't be saved until the Lord calls you. You have to feel like the Lord, you can't, it's not a decision you can make on your own. Basically, you can't just be like, yes, I want to be a Christian. You have to wait until that moment when God is like, now the time is right, or something like that. I don't know.
And do you hear a voice in your head that's God that says,
I don't know. I mean, it never happened.
Okay.
It never happened.
Fair.
So I don't know. I don't know what she heard in her head. Hmm. I don't know. But so we were all under the impression that we had to wait for God to call us. So it was very weird because it was like we never lost our faith. We definitely still like 100% bought into all of the religion and everything. And we were believers, but like we didn't feel like we were actually Christians. And I spent a lot of this time, I prayed a lot. And every night I was very scared to go to sleep because I thought that I might die in my sleep and go to hell. It was like a real fear that I had.
Oh, Erica.
And it was like, you just feel so powerless at that point because of the way that it was expressed was like, there's nothing I can do. Like, I just have to wait. And like, what if God doesn't come through, you know?
Oh.
So that kind of kept on and kept on. And, you know, it after a while, it's hard to stay scared, you know, this thing that kept not dying in my sleep, of course.
How can you live like that? I mean, there's no life.
Eventually, you just kind of stop thinking about it as much. And that's really what it was. Like, it was right at the end of high school. And so then I went off to college and I wasn't around my family so much. I still went to church on the weekends. I was dating my high school boyfriend who was still in high school. And so I went home every weekend and I met him at church. So we went to church. But like, I was just comfortable with the limbo that I was in at that point. I just kind of stopped thinking about it very much. And then we broke up. And as I went through college, I had friends who were Christians, but they weren't like outwardly religious. And so it was just really easy for me to sort of grow away from that part of my life.
Mm.
And I sort of never went back. Yeah.
Mm. That's hard.
Yeah.
Because your family are all still religious, right?
Yeah, for the most part. My mom and my sister aren't really religious. They'll go to church occasionally and like, you know, they're like, oh, yeah, we're Christians. We believe in God, et cetera, et cetera. But they're not like outwardly religious people.
Hmm.
My dad has always been very involved in the church. I mean, whenever it was me and my dad going to church, it was like 3 times a week. We'd go Sunday morning and we'd go for the Sunday evening service and we would go for the Wednesday night service. My dad always had to go because he ran the sound system.
Oh, got
it. So if I wasn't ever feeling very social and I didn't want to sit with the youth group, or like if mom wasn't there and I was too young to sit with the youth group still, I could just go up in the balcony where my dad's recording equipment was and I could sit up there with just dad. That was always fun.
Yeah, that's cool.
Nobody could see me, but I could
you
see
feel
them.
Like a VIP.
Yeah,
my dad
really
was
do.
In the choir and sometimes he would let us sit up there with him and you could see everything that was going on.
Yeah.
You felt
this was
very
in the
cool.
very back of the church is where we were at. So like I could look out and see everybody, but nobody could see us. They'd have to turn around.
That's pretty cool.
Don't do in church. But the first religious crisis, like after I got saved, and I was very fervent after that, like for a couple of years, I read my Bible 3 times a day. I had a schedule. I would read it in the morning when I woke up. I would read it in the evening after I took my shower, and then I'd read it right before I went to sleep.
And are you just reading it from the beginning continuously through?
I think I might have been doing that. Yeah. I don't know if I jumped around. My dad also had this Bible study that he knew of that I think I might have been following that, where like it put the books of the Bible in chronological order.
Oh,
I think
okay.
I was reading it that way. I think I was trying to read it in chronological order because I'd already read most of it before by that point.
And what is that doing for you when you're reading it 3 times a day?
I don't know. I guess it's just giving me like a false sense of security. I don't know. Do you ever have those days or those nights where you like jerk awake in the middle of the night and you're convinced that it's morning and so you like get out of bed and get dressed because you think you're late? I remember that happened to me one
time
during this time. I jerked awake and I was convinced that it was the morning and I was running late. So to get my day started, I grabbed my Bible off the floor next to my bed and I was like halfway through my self-assigned reading before I realized it was 3 a.m.
Whoa. Could you go back to sleep?
I went back to sleep, yeah. I didn't retain any of it, so I read it again in the morning.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's intense.
Yeah. So that's pretty much my whole religious life.
Yeah. It's, you know, a lot of what you're saying resonates with me, even though I was raised in a different religion from you, different form of Christianity. Yeah. And then negotiating, this is more like my stuff than yours maybe, but negotiating who you are in your family once you've stopped being this thing you had in common with them.
Yeah.
So like you talking about praying with your dad, like that sounds familiar to me. And, you know, thinking about who I am with my parents now that we have a difference between us in this area.
Yeah. I think my relationship with my dad definitely took a hit because of this during the really big crisis when I was in high school. I started writing a journal to try to explain like how I was feeling and I was scared that someone was going to find it. I hid it under my bed as far back as I could put. I had a double bed, and so like I couldn't reach all the way to the wall. So I had this big piece of cardboard that like came with a poster or something, and I would put the journal on the piece of cardboard, and then I would slide it all the way back. If I used my leg, I could push it against the wall, and then I could use my toes to pull the cardboard out. That's how hidden this was.
That's intense.
And then I decided that like I had kept it all to myself, and I decided that I wanted to tell my dad what I was going through, because he was like the spiritual figure in my life. So I was so scared, and like I couldn't talk to him. So I left my journal for him to read, and I think I gave it to him like before I went to bed, and I was so nervous. And then I woke up in the morning, and he had left my journal outside my bedroom door with a note. And the note basically said that I was wrong. He thought I was wrong, and that I was saved and I was a Christian.
Wow.
I know. So it's really hard to like lay yourself bare, and then your dad is just like, no.
How did you feel?
I mean, I felt not seen. I felt like he didn't listen, or like he wouldn't understand, like willfully. He blamed my youth leader. It just turns out a lot of people in the church didn't like her and the way she was doing stuff. And I mean, it kind of makes sense. Like I said, there was sort of a domino effect, like something in the water. There was like four of us in my youth group having the same problem. So like maybe it was something going on with like what she was telling us. I don't know. But I mean, it was really hard because we never talked about it after that. That was the end of the conversation. At that point, I was like, well, I can't tell him anything. I have to keep it all to myself now.
That's really tough.
Yeah. After I went to college in Arkansas, but then I moved away to Boston. And I mean, as sad as it is, it made it a lot easier. Just being away from that, it made it easier to like be myself.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in college, I was only an hour away from my family, but it was still very easy to like have my real self at college and then go home and like be who they thought I was. And honestly, now that I'm further away, I go home like once a year to visit. And now it's a lot harder to be who they think I am. Like the less I play that part, the harder it is to get back into it every time.
Yeah. I mean, do you find yourself slipping from your performance when you're there?
Oh yeah.
You have to catch yourself or. Yeah.
It's a good thing there are kids around now. My sister's got kids. That keeps me from cursing pretty well. Like you can't curse in my family. We always knew my dad was really mad if he said, damn, if he yelled at mom and said, damn, we knew he was so mad. But in my house, I couldn't say geez. Geez was too close to Jesus. And like my grandma was even stricter. At grandma's house, I couldn't say G, singular G. Grandma wouldn't let me say gosh either, because that was like saying God. Yeah.
Grandma is tough.
Yeah. My parents have loosened up a little bit. Like my dad says things suck now, which is big.
Whoa.
Yeah. I don't know why they were so strict when I was a kid.
We'll return with more chapters after this break. For our chapters listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. If you visit audible.com and sign up for a free 30-day trial, you can download an audiobook for free. Why not check out The Little Prince, a book that's proven very important to Erica for reasons we'll soon discover. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/chapters. Again, that's audibletrial.com/chapters for your free audiobook.
Did books play a role in that process of you finding who you feel like you really are or give you a space to feel seen?
I think because of the connection that I had with books. I did, you know, the Left Behind series?
Mm-hmm.
Those were like the only Christian books I ever really tried to read. I'm like, they're not that good, you know?
Are those the books that were made into a movie starring...
Yeah.
Kirk Cameron.
Oh yeah, we watched videos of Kirk Cameron. Like Kirk Cameron was super Christian, you know, and he would do like Bible study videos or something. We watched those at church. Kirk Cameron was a Christian celebrity.
Was he like a teen heartthrob for you?
No,
thank you.
He was not.
Wow.
But yeah, I think just. That I connected so much with books at this point, like I really started to see myself as a reader. And this is where I started to form relationships with books where I was like, oh, this book means something to me. And I would reread books, and that it was a big bond between me and Jessica. And Jessica was not in the church, and Jessica was in the church, which, by the way, when Jessica was in the church and I was struggling with it, she was way kinder. She did not talk down to me ever or like proselytize to me. She's, like I said, just a way better person than me.
You didn't get a Bible from her?
I did not, no. Although she knew I had a shelf of Bibles. Like, I had my pick.
Yeah.
Jessica was the only person in her family going to church when she was doing that.
Did she since stop doing that, or was this just like a window of time?
Yeah, we evened out in college, and then neither of us went to church anymore. Hmm. Now we're pretty much both heathens, the way we like it. But yeah, this time I was, I don't know, maybe, I mean, I guess you could interpret it how you want. Maybe I was grasping. This is like the only time in my life when I would go to the library and just like pick something up off the shelf. I remember I just, at random, I would pick books. Maybe I was going for short books. I don't know, because I know I read The Night Thoreau Spent in Jail. Weird choice. I read a book called Kissing Doorknobs about a girl that had OCD.
Okay.
Yeah. This is also when I found one of my absolute all-time favorite books, though. It's called The Only Alien on the Planet by Kirsten D. Randall.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read that?
I think I did a long time ago. God. Yeah.
No one's ever heard of it. Like, it's not a famous book.
Oh, I can see
the
cover in my mind. Yeah. Like, yeah, I remember that book.
I love that book so much.
Why do you love it so much?
I don't know, honestly. I really don't.
Hmm.
Maybe it's that thing of, like, being so removed, because like the main character obviously is removed because she's the new girl, but then there's this other kid who's like so much more removed than like any person has a right to be because of his whole like psychological distance from everyone. And then there's freaking Calder, who's trying to break down these walls with everybody. Like, come on, man, this isn't your place. But of course it's also a love story, and that's just appealing.
What books then, like, I think we're, like, in college now, like, what?
We kind of skipped over high school.
Okay, well, high school.
We can cover that briefly. Jessica and I kind of started to diverge a little more in high school.
Okay.
She kept going with, like, the fantasy stuff. And I said we were really into Tamra Pierce, which she stuck with that longer than I did. I think I was kind of done with, like, the YA fantasy before she was. So she read more of, like, her stuff that was coming out then, and I had stopped. And she was still reading books about dragons and stuff. And I was, I don't know what I was reading. I mean, at that point, I was doing reading for class and stuff like that.
Hmm.
My English teachers were always a big part of my life, of course. So yeah, I was reading a lot of like whatever was assigned for English class. Reading a lot of like Willa Cather and Scott Fitzgerald.
And do you like reading books that are assigned to you, or did that?
Sometimes it works out good. I read the Poisonwood Bible, and that one was amazing.
Hmm. Yeah.
That was a good one.
But what is the next like reading experience that really impacted you?
Oh, I got very into Diana Wynne Jones. Howl's Moving Castle is another one of my all-time favorites. This is when Jessica and I were both reading Diana Wynne Jones. There are certain books that when I was in high school, I loved them and I always read them in a single day. And now, honestly, like, it's part of what's holding me back from rereading some of my childhood favorites, I think, because I feel like if I didn't read them in a single day and if I didn't love them just as much, I'm somehow betraying the book or betraying my former self or something.
Hmm.
But yeah, Howl's Moving Castle is one that I would always read in one go. Only Alien on the Planet was another one. Little Prince, of course. But there's also this book called Crown Duel, which I found out later was actually two books that have been put together into an omnibus. A thing was like almost 500 pages long. And I always read it in a day. That was good. That one had a romance as a sideline, too.
So when do you want to talk about The Little Prince?
We can talk about it now. I think I started in high school.
Okay, so when was the first time you read that book? In church?
No. No. I started, it was related to church, why I started collecting editions of The Little Prince. I honestly have no idea why or when I first read it. It wasn't assigned in school. I don't know how I got my hands on it. I have no idea. No memory. But at first I wasn't collecting it. I liked the book. Like, every time I read it, I cry. Like, it's so moving.
Mm-hmm.
So
what moves you about that book?
Oh, man. I mean, it's such like a deep meditation on like what friendship is and what love is. Love like between friends. It's just, I mean, it gets you. And then the little prince like dies or doesn't die at the end. And you're like, oh, God, and the bells and the stars. But it's the little prince. He has this whole journey of like, he's mad at his rose because his rose is kind of a bitch. And then it's like, yeah, but she's my bitch. And so he comes around, and the whole thing with like the aviator too, like getting to know the little prince more and more every day and taking care of him, just like the little prince took care of his rose. And then, like, you gotta let him go, you know? You can't hold him back. The little prince needed to go home, and he had to let him. Yeah.
It just makes you emotional every time.
It makes me emotional every time, yeah. It's just it's a very heartfelt story, and it's told so simply, but it gets at such deep themes. I don't know. It's like a really concentrated package. It's a deep gut punch every time.
It is. I know a lot of people who really love that book,
yeah,
and have like an emotional relationship to, yeah, it.
I think it's because the themes are so versatile. Mm-hmm. Like, you could really make that book be about anything you want it to be about, which is kind of probably actually why I started lending it out. I had a friend from church who, it's going to sound bad. She had a friend who committed suicide. And so she was going through a hard time. And me being me, I decided to recommend a book to her. And I loaned her my copy of The Little Prince. I don't lend books to people anymore. I never got that book back. Yeah, I never got it back. She ended up moving out of her house with her family and moving in with our youth leader. And just like in the chaos, I never got the book back.
So you didn't lend her a Bible, though?
No, I met her at church. She had a Bible.
Oh, so you didn't, but you didn't like take it to a religious place and say like, you've gone through this hard time.
No, I mean, it felt like she was getting the religion from other places since she was in the church.
So at that point, was that your only copy of The Little Prince?
It was, yeah. So I bought another copy to replace it. And then I had another friend from church who was going through a breakup, I think with that same girl. But he was having a hard time. So I loaned him my copy of The Little Prince, you know, about loss and whatever. He moved to Florida and I never got that book back.
Wow.
And so I bought another copy of The Little Prince. At this point, I think I had been burned twice. So I kind of just started hoarding them. If I found another copy, I bought it. I just needed to not lose this book again. And eventually I had enough that I was like, I'm going to call it a collection. And then I'm collecting them now. But it was definitely hoarding.
So you just, like, it starts from this impulse of not wanting to be without this book that means a lot to you. And now it's grown into quite a collection.
Yes. Yeah. It's a lot.
How many copies of this book do you have?
Oh, man. I wrote down some stats in preparation for this question. I have a spreadsheet where I catalog all the books that I own, which I started explicitly to keep track of all my little princes. So there are 49 books in the collection. 30 of those actually contain the full original text of The Little Prince. The rest is made up of like a few biographies of the author, a couple of his other works. Some kids' books are just like abridged versions or like reinterpretations of the character. I have a coloring book, I have a notebook, I have a book of quotations, all sorts of stuff in the collection. All book items that are related to The Little Prince, I consider part of the collection. Non-book items don't count, like my socks and my tote bags. Those don't count.
Yeah. So how has it changed at all, if any, your relationship, if at all, with this book by collecting it?
I used to try to read it every year, and every year it was like just 1 to 2 hours of me reading and then crying. But then I did, we'll talk about this, I'm sure. I did a year, where my reading challenge for myself was not to read anything by white men. So I didn't read it that year, and I've kind of like fallen off the wagon since then. I haven't read it in a while. But now, honestly, it's really nice because I keep getting them as gifts. And it's been a really fun and meaningful way to connect with my friends, because my friends will give me a copy of The Little Prince that means something to them. So I had a friend who, she gave me a copy of The Little Prince in Hungarian for my birthday because she's of Hungarian descent. And so it like meant something to her and it meant something to me. I had a friend who, she studies Italian. And so she gave me a copy of The Little Prince in Italian because I didn't have one. And she thought that was a travesty. So that was a way for us to connect over the book too. I mean, since this book is so everywhere, like it means something to everybody who reads it. And it's very common to find it in other languages because it's a good introduction to a language. They teach it a lot in like beginning French classes and things. So it's so simple. It's translated into so many languages and it's like in so many incarnations. It's really easy for people to find a way to connect to it. And then that becomes a way to connect with me too. So it's been really interesting as it evolves in that direction.
That's really cool.
My friends who travel will bring me back copies from their travels. Jessica brought me one from China.
That's so neat.
I got one for myself when I was studying abroad in Germany. I bought it in our little local bookshop.
That's so cool. So it becomes like a time capsule and a bridge with your friends to like keep developing those friendships.
Yeah. And as the collection grows, like I keep track of where I got them all or who gave them to me. So the path is always there. I just bought 4 copies when I was in Portland because I was at Powell's bookstore. And they had 4 amazing copies that I had not had before. And I had to have them. I had to.
You had to.
It was only like $50.
You had to have it.
I did.
It's for your collection.
My goal is to one day own a signed copy.
Wow.
I need to marry Rich.
Yeah. How much are those going for?
A lot. I go to the Boston Antiquarian Book Fair every year.
Uh-huh.
It's a lot. First editions or signed editions are so expensive.
Like, give me a ballpark.
Oh, like over $25,000.
What?
Yeah.
My God. Maybe we'll start a Chapters Kickstarter for you.
Yeah. Do it. I made my first purchase at the Antiquarian Book Fair last year, actually, and it was a Little Prince book, but it was it's in German and it's a puzzle book and it's got like this pillow cover and it's an abridged text and the illustrations are puzzle pieces you can pop out and work the puzzle.
That's cool. Mm-hmm.
And I was happy to find it because it's really unique, but I was also like just really impressed with myself that I made a purchase at the Boston.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you feel very posh when you were like, I want to buy this?
Yeah, but it was cash only because it was under a certain amount. So I had to go find an ATM and come back.
Wow.
Made me feel a little less posh. I actually borrowed money from my friend because her bank doesn't charge ATM fees.
Smooth.
Mm-hmm.
So what's next in your, that you want to talk about?
If you want to hear a little more about religion.
Sure.
I mentioned that I read the Harry Potter books and my dad was reading those too. So like my dad was this religious figure in my life. So it's kind of like Harry Potter is okay. Some of my family that was more religious was like Harry Potter is not okay. But around the time that the final book came out, one of my super religious friends convinced me that Satan was in Harry Potter. And so I did not actually read the 7th book. I stopped at book 6 and I didn't read the 7th book for like 3 or 4 more years. Just a little fun story.
Wow.
Yeah. That was hard. Everybody was talking about it.
So you were not tempted at all to look up spoilers or see what you were missing at all? You were just trusting that religious-wise, this was the best move for your soul, not to expose yourself to Satan in the form of the last Harry Potter?
Yeah. I think it probably also, that was when I was feeling very vulnerable. So I think I didn't want to run any extra risks.
Yeah.
So.
Got it.
I came back to it later, though.
And did you like the last book?
Yeah, it was good. I'm watching the movies with my boyfriend right now, who hasn't really read the books. We just watched the 6th one last night. And I told him, I was like, the next movie is basically like Harry Potter goes camping. And then the last movie is like Harry Potter and the Battle of Hogwarts.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah. So I read Harry Potter, the last book, in college. I finished that. I also read the popular Hunger Games series.
Yep.
I read the first one of those when I was a senior in high school, and then I was very upset to find out that the rest of the books were not written yet. I was already trying to read things that were already done. Like, if I picked up a series, I'm like, I don't want to wait 2 years for the next book.
Got it.
So I'll pick up a finished series. But somebody recommended me Hunger Games, and I didn't do my research. I read it, and I loved it, and the next books weren't out. So I was in college, and I used the Hunger Games books to motivate myself. They were like a reward. Whenever a new one came out, I wouldn't let myself buy it until I finished whatever big paper I was working on at the time. That was my system.
Hmm.
But other than that, I didn't really do a lot of extracurricular reading in college. I was an English major, so I was doing a lot of reading for class. But I did have a lot of really good professors, and I took a lot of interesting classes that definitely impacted my reading life. I took this really cool class called Victorian Masculinities. Which was super fun. We read Adam Bede by George Eliot. And that was the first Victorian novel. Like, it's a doorstop. That was the first Victorian novel I read. It was a page-turner for me. I was like, what happens next? Like, I need to keep going. I was reading, like, beyond the weekly assignments and stuff.
Hmm.
So that really, like, opened me up to more Victorian literature as, like, not boring. I think I read Tale of Two Cities, and, like, it was fine. It was not as hard to get through as people said it was.
Hmm.
But Adam Bede really, like, did it for me. Hmm. Later on, I read Middlemarch, even. Yeah, I liked it. I hated Mill on the Floss, though. Fuck Mill on the Floss.
Tough take. Well, why?
That ending is bullshit. Oh, man. I was reading this book. What, did Edith Wharton write this? I was reading this book and, like, just going along, going along, going along. And then on, like, the last five pages, the town floods and they die. And I was like, that is such a cop-out.
Like, just no kill resolution. Everyone at the end.
Yeah, there's no resolution to any of these issues that came up, like the relationship between her and her brother, and the relationship between her and her cousin, her and her ex-lovers. There's none of that resolution. She's an outcast, and then the town floods, and they die.
Yeah, I mean,
such a cop-out.
It's making me think that Shonda Rhimes may not be for you.
Oh, man, we need a spoiler alert on this, by the way.
Yeah.
This super old novel.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like if people have had time to check that out, but, you know... Maybe people will pick it up now because you've ruined it and they want to see it for themselves.
And nonfiction, I had never really read much of. That was another thing that I was like, oh, nonfiction. It's boring. It's dry. I have no interest in that. I was definitely a fiction person. So I took this class. Excuse me. I really liked the professor and I took his class. And that kind of opened me up to like a whole world of what nonfiction could be. We read all sorts of stuff. We read like David Foster Wallace a little bit. We read some Dave Hickey, Dave Eggers, all the Daves and Davids. We hit those. We read Joan Didion, which is amazing. Nicholson Baker, all sorts of good stuff. But it was also, it was an equal parts reading and a writing class. And so I had to do some writing. I took exactly one creative writing class when I was in college, and for my final story, I wrote a story called Winner Takes All, and it was about a guy competing in a Scrabble championship, and his opponent was also his romantic rival. So I don't know if I have much of a future in writing.
I mean, are you going to sell that to Hallmark? They would buy that.
My proudest part of the whole thing was that I downloaded a font that looks like Scrabble tiles to put the title in. That was the best part.
Wow.
But in my creative nonfiction class, we had a lot of really interesting and different assignments. It was a really good way for me to work out like my leftover teen angst. We had an assignment to write an essay about an act of violence that was committed against us. So I wrote about an emotionally abusive ex-boyfriend that I had. We had an assignment. The final assignment was to write an autobiography, but the autobiography had to be the same number of pages as years old that you were at the time.
Okay.
Every page of that biography could only have one sentence or one quote. Yeah. And it had to be like a certain percentage of your own voice and a certain percentage of other people's voices. So I remember I quoted song lyrics. I had a couple different quotes from fun songs. They were big at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. So that was like me working out all my religious crap on the page with fun song lyrics.
That sounds good. I'd like to see that book.
Yeah. That, how many pages? 21 pages long, maybe?
Mm-hmm. 21 sentences. I want to see your 21 page autobiography.
I think it's on my external hard drive, which I can't access anymore because I had a Mac and now I have a PC. And so my hard drive doesn't like it anymore.
Wow.
It won't connect to my PC.
That sounds like an excuse and one that you could get around.
I know, I need to. I need to see that again.
Yeah, I want to see it.
I remember that the one about the act of abuse, I showed it to my current boyfriend, and I was like, you should read this, and you'll understand me better.
Wow, and how did that go?
I mean, no one ever really reacts as strongly as you want them to your, like, proclamations of, this is who I am, you know? It's always a little disappointing.
Did he make you feel seen?
I don't know about in that case, but overall, not really. It was also my senior year of college that this is gonna be big news for you, Mary. I realized that I was asexual when I was a senior in college. I found out. I first heard the term asexual from a Stuff You Should Know podcast.
Okay.
They did an episode on what asexuality is. I was like, oh.
Can you describe what that is?
I can. Yeah. Asexuality is a sexual orientation, but it's defined by the lack of sexual attraction. So some aces or asexual people, they do experience romantic attraction, which that's my case. I'm heteroromantic, but you can be homoromantic or you can be aromantic and not experience romantic attraction. You can also be on the spectrum but not be fully asexual. You can be a gray asexual, which is when you are attracted to people in certain circumstances. Like if you form an emotional bond with someone, you are able to experience sexual attraction to them, things like that. But yeah, I heard about it on the Stuff You Should Know podcast, and I was like, oh, this sounds intriguing. And I looked into it more, and the more I read about it, the more I was like, this really fits my personal experience. And so I started using the term then, and I haven't stopped. But I was dating this guy at the time, and I didn't tell him. It was my first, like, grown-up sexual relationship.
Okay.
Yeah, so I didn't tell him. We broke up at one point and got back together. And when we got back together, we had this, like, you know, like, airing your grievances. Like, this is what needs to be different. Or, like, these are things you need to know that I was keeping from you.
Yeah.
So I told him two things. I told him, one, I'm asexual and I want you to know that. And I told him, two, I also have had a crush on this guy that I haven't told you about. Like, we're, like, we have mutual friends. We hang out sometimes. But I've had a crush on him and I didn't tell you. This is when I didn't feel seen, because my boyfriend got so hung up on me having a crush on this other guy. Like, we never talked about the asexual thing. He was just like, oh my God, you like someone else?
Yeah, he's like, so anyway, this like, other
that's
person.
Not the news here.
So can I ask a question that kind of betrays my own ignorance, but I'm just trying to like understand.
I love talking about it.
Okay. When you say that you're asexual and that there's a spectrum of what that can mean in terms of like attractions, and you can have a sexual attraction to someone with whom you have an emotional relationship, does this mean then that you're interested in having sex with people, but it has to be in a specific situation? Or you're not overly interested in being like, you don't have the capacity or the interest of being sexually attracted to someone?
I personally, I think I'm like full on asexual. I don't have a sex drive to speak of at all.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's kind of awkward. Like, at different points in my life, people have thought I was a lesbian because I don't engage when they talk about like hot guys and stuff. I thought I was passing really well in college. But like when I came out to my friends, they were like, oh, we thought maybe you were gay. Because apparently they would like talk to me about dudes that they liked or that they had fucked or whatever. And I was like not giving the normal reaction, I guess.
So see, I also got that response. I also was doing that. And it turns out
everybody knew something was up.
Yeah. Then I was like, this is my girlfriend. People were like, oh, okay.
Yeah. My family has, every time that I've gone more than like a year without a boyfriend, my family is always like, oh, huge sigh of relief when I start dating someone. They're like, oh, we were worried you were gay.
God.
Like I said, my family's very religious.
Sure, of course.
My sister has told me that she thought I was a lesbian, all sorts of stuff. Uh-huh. So apparently I was not normal, although I thought I was just a normal teen, I guess.
Sure.
But yeah, I don't have a sex drive to speak of, which isn't to say that I don't enjoy sex. Like, I'm physically able to enjoy having sex. It's just like I never crave that. I'm never like, oh man, I want to have sex with that person or like.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've had some asexual friends in the past and they've all been sex averse. Mm. So that's my only experience with it. And like their difficulties in dating and trying to feel comfortable enough sharing who they are and then finding potential partners who are okay with that.
Yeah.
So
it's hard to know when to bring it up. I did a lot of online dating. That's how I met Brendan. So I was on OkCupid for like 2 years. I was living in Boston and it was hard to know like when to bring it up with a date. Having been raised religious, like I was not very sexually experienced anyway. And so sex was like kind of still a big deal to me. So even without bringing that up, I was like, ooh, let's not move too fast, you know? Eventually, I was like, fuck it. Like, people need to know going in, and I want them to know, like, where I'm coming from. So I put it, like, right out on my profile. I had it in two places. On OkCupid, you can identify your sexual orientation, and asexual is an option. So I put it there. But people weren't seeing that. People were skimming the profile. So I put it in what's the most private thing you're willing to admit, which I thought everyone would read that. That's, like, the juicy stuff on a profile. So I put it there that I'm asexual. And I would still get all these guys going on dates, and then we're like on date two, and I'd mention that I'm asexual, and they're like, what? Even Brendan. Brendan did not know. I brought it up casually later, and he was like, what? People don't read the profile, you guys.
That's a problem.
This is the lesson you should take away
from this. Yeah. So you got to read those profiles.
Mm-hmm. Don't assume that they know anything if you put it online.
Wow. That's crazy. I mean, do you think that like we're in a turning point where, I mean, I grew up in a religious background too. And the way that that affected how I understood or thought about sex is that like I didn't because it was never spoken about except like as a danger or a path to sin or, you know, like that scene in Mean Girls where it's like, if you have sex, you'll get pregnant and die or whatever that line is. Like,
yeah.
I mean,
you will get pregnant. and you will die.
You will die.
You will get chlamydia, sure. And you will die.
You'll be riddled with syphilis, and you will die.
Did you see those pictures when you were in health class? They, like, pass around the disease.
Are you kidding? Pictures? No, I went to Catholic high school, so it was just like, do not have sex. Well,
it was still to teach us abstinence. It was like, look what will happen to your lady bits if you have sex.
Like a scared straight program. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, like, you don't know not only anything about sex, but you don't know anything about the spectrum of, like, sexual desires, mm-hmm. orientations.
Yeah.
And now it's like, it's particularly in, like, YA culture, there's books emerging that have, like, an asexual character, mm-hmm. just as, like, a part of the book. And I think that that's so, it's such a cool development to be kind of, like, living through and seeing these changes, and kind of makes me envious that I'm not, like, a teen now, like, reading these books,
yeah.
you know, because I know for myself, like, coming to trying to understand my own orientation or desire, like, my instinct was to go seek out fiction and seek out books and see if that resonated with me, mm-hmm. like, with queer characters. And for you, like, if that was even something you were inclined to do, like, that's not a super option.
I think for me, maybe being asexual made it easier to be in the church and not think about sex. Mm-hmm. Like, I wasn't thinking about it. And my first boyfriend, I met him at church, and we started dating when I was just about to turn 17. So, like, we should have been thinking about it, and he probably was, but, like, we were both very religious. We were both, like, waiting for marriage, you know? So, like, we never talked about it or anything. And, like, it wasn't really an issue. We did stuff, but, like, we didn't have sex. His mom was very lenient. We got to be in his room with the door closed.
Whoa.
Stuff happened. Yeah. While Lord of the Rings played in the background, stuff happened.
Very hot.
But also, I think he didn't want to go too far because he was very self-conscious. I found out later that he actually only had one testicle. He had lost one to testicular torsion. And he was really self-conscious about it, which I think is another reason that he didn't push me. So honestly, like, I never thought about it. Like, I didn't think about it at all. Like, nothing felt weird until I was in this, like, first sexual relationship when I was in college. And I was a senior in college at this point.
Hmm.
I didn't date much in college. I had that emotionally abusive boyfriend, but that was long distance, so there wasn't a whole lot of sex stuff.
Jeez.
Yeah. So that was the first time that I had noticed, like, a difference between what was expected of me, I guess, by society, and what I actually felt or wanted.
Mm.
So I had never really explored it. Like, to me, it always felt normal. Like, I didn't feel different, I guess, because no one around me was really talking about sex. Like, I had always been so like, closed off and shut down from that for religious reasons that, like, it never occurred to me it was any other reason.
Hmm.
And it didn't seem weird.
Yeah, so you could kind of, like, almost hide in plain sight,
yeah.
as an asexual person. Mm-hmm. And the adjustment wasn't a change in the desire or the lack thereof. It was just sort of, like, the reason behind,
yeah.
the desire.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not doing this because I think it's a sin. I'm going to go to hell. It's mm-hmm. just
part of who I am.
Part of who I am.
Yeah. They call it the invisible orientation.
Hmm.
We hide very easily. Although not as easily as I thought, I guess.
Not anymore.
That's a problem, too. It's like, people don't know that it even exists sometimes. And so everybody assumed I was gay. Because mm-hmm. I didn't like boys. But I didn't like girls either.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Honestly, though, like, I've thought about it. And I feel like my family, like I said, they don't like the gays, and they worried that I might be a gay. Mm-hmm. And I honestly don't know if they would react worse if I came out as a lesbian or if I came out as asexual.
My guess is lesbian.
Oh, I don't know. Like, at least gay people, they're, like, aware of, and they sort of, like, have come to terms with, and they understand that. Like, everybody knows a gay person now, and it's, like, not the end of the world. But, like, asexuality is something that would be totally foreign to them. They don't know. And I mean, part of Christianity is, like, it's more in Catholicism for sure, but, like, you're supposed to procreate. Like, God gives you your spouse, and you're supposed to have that carnal relationship. And I feel like not having a sex drive or sexual attraction, they might perceive that in some way as going against God. Like, it's unnatural.
Hmm.
It's like, in a similar way as homosexuality is unnatural to them, but, like, in a way that they even more don't understand.
I don't think it's that they don't understand. I think they just don't care for it.
Well, even outside the church, a lot of people don't understand asexuality.
Of course. I mean, we've gotten, like, far afield of your reading life.
Yeah. I never
And I'm trying to think about how to bring it back, but
I never really sought out asexual people in literature because I knew that they weren't there. Mm. Like, I had read widely. I felt like I would have encountered it if it had been there. But I also, like, I was pretty comfortable with it. I mean, I didn't date very much, so it wasn't a problem very often. It's only been pretty recently that I've started to want to find books that I can see myself in. Like, it's never really been an issue for me. Like, growing up, I wasn't trying to find myself through reading or anything like that. I was reading because it was fun and I liked it. But now it's like I'm really starting to feel like I don't see myself in books that exist. Mm-hmm. And it's not just being asexual. It's also being child-free. Like, I don't want to have kids ever. And that's, like, another hard thing for society to accept. And it's hard to find books about, like, strong female characters who, like, they're not having babies or thinking about having babies or already had babies or planning to have babies. It's hard.
Now, you mentioned before that there was a year recently when you decided to read books that were not by white men. Mm-hmm. Did, when you were reading those books, did you find any more representation of women who chose to not be mothers and, like, normalize that? Or was that equally just not in there?
Mm. I don't remember anything like that sticking out. No, sorry.
But are you finding any books, though, or, like, you have this desire where you want to be seen in mm-hmm. terms of, like, this choice not to be a mother, to know that about yourself and see that reflected in what you read and get some kind of affirmation from that. Are you finding that anywhere?
I'm certainly looking for it. Like, just the other day, I Googled child-free authors, like, added a few books to my list. But, I mean, a lot of the, if you, like, look for child-free books, a lot of what you're going to find is nonfiction. You would be in, like, oh, living the child-free life, it's normal. And, like, here's essays about not having kids.
Or everything is fine. Yeah. Everything is fine. Yeah.
I read that book that came out called Selfish, Shallow, and Self-Absorbed. And it was a bunch of writers who contributed essays about their decision not to have kids. And some of it was, like, I decided not to have kids because of, like, health issues. Like, I might pass something on. And some people were, like, I don't want to bring a child into this world. And some people were, like, I don't like kids. That's the one I relate to. But it was, like, a whole array of perspectives. And, like, none of it really felt like my perspective still.
Right.
I think I've recently, this year, gotten into mysteries. I've been reading, like, I started this year off reading the first Hercule Poirot book by Agatha Christie, Mysterious Affair at Styles, and I immediately followed it up with A is for Alibi by Sue Grafton, the first of her ABC series. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I was thinking about it a while back, and I think that Kinsey Millhone from the ABC murder series, she might be, like, the closest I found to my identity in literature. She's a child-free woman. She's divorced 3 times. She has really long dry spells in, like, her sex life. She'll go a couple of years, and then she'll, like, have a fling, and then go another couple of years. And she doesn't really, she's not, like, constantly thinking about sex or talking about sex. She's definitely not a maternal figure. Hmm. She, like, lives on her sleeper sofa, and she has a crush on her 80-year-old landlord. Like, she's so far from the mainstream, and it's so amazing. And she's like, this is who I am. Like, I know who I am. And if you're not okay with it, you can go away. You don't have to sleep with me or not sleep with me or whatever we're talking about doing.
Hmm.
So I found her to be a really nice character.
And what did that mean to you to find someone that you, like, felt simpatico with?
Well, obviously, I'm not solving mysteries, although private investigator is my backup career option.
Same.
Mm-hmm. I think I'd be good at it. Although Kinsey gets real, she talks about how it's easier for a man to be a private investigator because they can pee in a bottle. She has to leave a steak out to go to the bathroom, and that's not good. It's not good.
Yeah.
These books, they're real.
They hit the hard-hitting issues.
Yeah, they do. I mean, when I first started reading it, it's new for me to, like, be reading genre fiction. I've always started out as a kid being a book snob, you know, and then as I was an adult, I was like, literary fiction. Yes, I read literary fiction. But now I'm really disillusioned with literary fiction. I'm like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, it has so many of its own tropes and I'm sick of it. I'm done reading about rich white people who have problems. Like, that's fine. They can go have their problems and I'll be over here living my life. So I've branched into, like, mysteries and I'm really enjoying it. I don't know. Like, I didn't start off thinking about Kinsey as, like, me or, like, relating to me. But I did instantly think of, like, oh, this is refreshing. I know it was groundbreaking when the books first came out that there was, like, such a strong woman
mm-hmm.
who was, like, not a sidekick or a femme fatale or anything. It was a big deal. But yeah, I found it really refreshing. Like, it's set in the 80s and it's very 80s. She wears nylons, but it's still like really empowering just because you still don't see that many women like this who are there making their own choices with no regret and like no regard for what society thinks they should be doing. And like, I've only read three of the books so far. I'm really pacing myself so that I can drag this out. I just got D's for Deadbeat out of the library. So this might all change later on. I don't know if she weakens or anything, or if Sue Grafton gives in to pressure. But like, so far, societal pressure like hasn't even reared its ugly head in these books. Like, she's done such a good job of removing herself from people who would be negative about her lifestyle. And that's a really cool thing too.
That is really cool.
And none of my friends like these books.
So I've heard. No one wants to go on this journey with you.
No, maybe if they listen to this podcast and they realize how much it means to me.
Or maybe one of our listeners will listen and, you know, want to talk to you about it on the Facebook group or something.
Yes, if anybody's looking for a strong female character from the 80s, hit up Sue Grafton.
Wow.
If you don't like some predictable mystery novel shenanigans. Although to me, they're not that predictable. I'm still new to the genre.
Erica, this has been a dream. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. This was a good time.
I'd like to thank our guest Erica for sharing her story with us. I'd also like to thank our producer Taylor for all of her help. You can find us on Twitter at ChaptersPod. You can find me at MaryMahoney123 and Taylor at MJTThePhD. You can find us on Instagram at ChaptersPod. There you'll find shelfies submitted by our guests. Follow our page on Facebook, and you can get updates on the show and join conversations about each episode with other listeners. If you enjoy our show, please rate and review us in the iTunes store. It really helps listeners find our show. Thanks for listening.